marvelous things he did in the sight of their fathers. Welcome back to Hackberry House, a podcast devoted to the Word of God and the persecuted Church of North Korea. My name is Bob. This is podcast number 412. It is March 6, 2016. Well, a man we've been following has to pay a price for his faith in this episode. We're in the 1990s. The book is These Are the Generations, written by Pastor Eric Foley and Mr. and Mrs. Bay, who gave him the story. It's available at Amazon.com. I hope you'll purchase that very soon. Read along with me. I'm on page 48. She, that is a girl that Mr. Bay has just met as he tells his story to Pastor Foley, she would come to the college for these teacher training events. Never, of course, would a woman talk to a man first, so the first three times we passed each other in the hall, we just made eye contact. Now, she had her things to do in the college, and I had my classes. But as we passed each other, each time after that, I began to ask her questions. Where do you live? How old are you? I wanted to go deeper, so I needed an excuse to build a relationship. Fortunately, the graduation requirements provided me one. In order to graduate, you needed to submit a lot of research papers. You had to write a paper about Kim Il-sung's strategy of war, and you had to write other long papers on each of 80 quotes of his, and what they meant, and what they meant to you, and how you would strive your whole life long to follow him. You had to have great handwriting and exactly the right answers. Then you had to write still more papers about the 100 quotes of Kim Jong-il. And then on top of that, you had to take a test, a comprehensive exam on all things Kim. And you had to write a thesis. So I had a ready-made excuse to go deeper. I didn't know whether she was a good writer, but I knew I needed the help. And so I asked, and she said yes. Now, when a single North Korean woman sees a single North Korean man, they always see if the man is a party member, whether he's finished with army service. A man who did not complete army service is a man who must have had bad health. A man who completed army service as a Communist Party member is a man whose family background must be okay and hasn't had any theft or women problems. And a man who completed his military service, joined the party, and enrolled in college? Only rare men would be sent to college. Most men would be sent to the mines or to the factory to work, even if they were Communist Party members. So a college man like that would be very popular indeed. The right kind of a man to say yes to when he asks for help with his graduation homework. She was not the first woman I had met. In fact, I had said no to 57 women who had been recommended to me over 3 years. Most men who finish army duty get married within a year, not me. After having worked so hard for so long to reverse the fortunes of our family, I wasn't about to risk a bad marriage. And there was something different about this woman. She agreed to help me with my graduation papers, and I gave her 1 month to get my assignments done. But she sent a letter 2 weeks later letting me know that the papers were complete. I made arrangements to visit her home to pick them up. We ate lunch together with her parents, and afterward I examined the papers. I was absolutely blown away. She was a great writer, and everything about the papers was flawless. My major was engineering. In order to graduate, I had to complete an engineering assignment, too. I could do numbers and planning and drawing, but the writing part was beyond me. And, of course, I wanted to get closer to her and build our relationship. And so I asked her for help on this additional assignment, and she readily agreed. And her parents liked me. Many guys had been introduced to her, she said, but none were as good as me. In order to get that final assignment done, I went to her two-room house. Her parents stayed in one room, and we worked on the assignment in the other. We only had time in the evening, after work and school. We worked together 3 days, until 1 or 2 a.m. each time. That gave us time to talk, too. She told me how so many of the guys who were interested in her had tried to hold her hand, but she noted that I didn't. I was focusing on the task. And she said that that convinced her that my character was good. On that third day, when we completed the assignment, there was no longer any pretext left for us to get together. So I asked her if she had anyone in mind for marriage. It was the first time I had openly raised the subject. She said no, she had no one in mind. So I asked her if anyone had been introduced to her by her parents, and she said no one that she was interested in. She asked me the same things. I said no. And then I proposed right away. I really want to think about marriage with you. I'm not against it, she said. Each of us talked to our parents, and the matter was set. I met her in February, graduation month, and we married in May, 3 months later. At that time, all the students who graduated from college or university were immediately sent to the most important projects the nation was undertaking: atomic power stations, fertilizer production plants, factories of various kinds. Newspaper and television reports trumpeted the successes of each project. But those of us who worked there knew better. I was assigned to a factory project for 8 years. The problems I saw there mirrored the problems our nation was having as a whole. The great leader died. The Soviet Union collapsed. It was as if the will of the country, not to mention its electricity and food and the last vestiges of its compassion, were sucked completely outside of its borders. When I completed the factory project, I found a job in my hometown in the mid-90s. At that time, all distribution had ground to a halt. That meant that, although you worked, you didn't get paid. The dark shadow of famine brooded over nearly every city, village, family. Many times I passed by the apartment where we had lived until we were exiled to the countryside. Now our starvation had followed us back even to this place. One day, the child of a neighbor died. The next evening, it was the neighbor on the back side of our home, an old woman who slumped, lifeless, starved to death in her own home. It's a very somber thing to see a dead person. I had never encountered it before in my whole life, even while in the military. And now dead bodies were everywhere, absolutely everywhere. Dead bodies on the street, dead bodies in the houses and apartments all around us, dead bodies piled up at the train station. One time I went to the station to catch a train. I had to wait there about an hour. 80 orphaned children were huddled together for warmth, and 7 of them were dead. Kochebi, we call such children, worthless swallows, dead birds, children whose parents had died and who had nowhere to go because no one would give them anything. No one could give them anything. No one had anything to give. I could not help but remember my own starvation as a boy, as I watched the station attendant chase the living children away so he could throw away the dead bodies, worthless swallows. I made a decision at that time. I should work in a job outside of manufacturing and construction. If you worked in manufacturing and construction, you ended up dead. There was no money to be paid to workers in those professions. No money meant no food, which meant starvation. Fortunately, my education and party membership afforded me some options. Since 1980, there had been a campaign to earn foreign money and bring it into the country. Of course, people did this illegally on the black market all the time. But people of the highest rank could be tasked by the government with earning foreign money legally. And at the time of the famine, this was the only money to be had. So this is how I entered the world of international trade. Of course, international trade in North Korea mainly means doing business with China, selling different kinds of North Korean vegetables and mineral ore, North Korea is a mountainous land, nearly impossible to farm on the top, as I had learned painfully in my childhood, but abundant in mineral resources underground. These are dug up by all the soldiers who are sent to the mines when they complete their military service. They're sold to China as raw ore by soldiers like me, who were fortunate enough to be able to go on to college. It's all sold right out of the ground to China and Russia and such places because there's no electricity and no skill to refine the ore into a higher grade. It's a sad matter. It was a sad matter of a different sort, however, that ultimately collapsed in upon our family, which had by then grown to include our two children. Through my position in the party and my education and my work in international trade, we could stave off the famine. But through all the changes in my life, there was one thing that I had inherited from my grandparents and my parents that I never could leave behind. Our family's own peculiar raw ore, which even then I had little ability to refine. I knew little about that mysterious faith of my grandfather, and I knew even less about that mysterious God of his who had called him by name in the times of the troubles of his own people. But when my best friend, who was struggling in his marriage, asked my wife and me how we managed to live a happy life, I could not help but to tell him the truth. There are 10 commandments, I told him, and heaven is always watching. When you break them, you ask heaven for forgiveness. And when you receive food, you give thanks. It was apparently not enough to repair the struggle in his own marriage. Generally, it's not legal to get divorced in North Korea, and the process is very difficult. You have to offer proof that the person you are divorcing is quite a bad fellow. And if that bad fellow is someone known to be standing against the communist ideology, well, a society has to have priorities, you know. That's how I ended up going to prison for bearing the name of God. It was odd that it all happened so close to the place where the NIS had barged in so many years before. And in many ways, the whole process of investigation wasn't much different than what I remembered experiencing in my childhood. Only this time, there'd be no going home at the end of the daily interrogation. It was clear from the beginning that I would never be going home again at all. Those who were closest to me were also dragged in for investigation. Some of them lied about me, telling the State Security Department agents whatever they wanted or needed to hear. But who could blame them? Who needed trouble with the state? Now, my crime was far worse than selling illegal watches or trafficking opium, however. I had corrupted my friend through my religious superstitions, which was the worst of political crimes. As an international trader, I was especially suspect. Not only must I have been pocketing money that rightly belonged to the state, but I must also have been undermining the state with my criticisms. Evangelism, embezzlement, treason. Now, there's a trio of allegations that only had one outcome: death by execution. What ensued was, as near as I've been able to gather from those around me at the time and those North Korean defectors with whom I've spoken since, something without parallel in North Korean judicial history. More than a year in the harshest prison conditions without formally being charged, while the government investigated the case. I was treated like an insect in prison. Every day of those 13 months was the same. Up at 5 a.m., mop the floor, clean up, go to the restroom, throw out the contents of the bucket, and then I had to sit cross-legged with my hands on my knees in the same position for the next 17 hours. I was not permitted to turn my neck or slouch with my back. Every 2 hours we were allowed to urinate. The only other time we were allowed to move was during meals, which were exactly 1 minute long. At 10 p.m. we were allowed to go to bed, but our heads had to be turned away from the prison bars. Bed meant lying down on the wooden floor. When you're sitting, you cannot move, even if you get bit by a mosquito. If you even flinch, you receive punishment. Torturous humiliations dreamed up by the guards. In one punishment, you'd have to stand with your knees bent, holding a full bowl of water over your head for 30 minutes. If you spilled even a drop, you'd be beaten senseless with a rod. For another punishment, you had to extend your hands through the prison bars so the guard on the other side could mash your palms into bloody ribbons of flesh with a sharp iron spike. You might be ordered to hang from a bar for half an hour or crawl like an insect across the wooden floor. Mostly, though, I just sat unmoving for 17 hours a day for more than a year of my life. During that time, I came to think a lot about my life and all that I had experienced to that point. I thought about how, during my army duty, I had buried God's love in a back room of my heart and instead received love from my superiors. I thought about how I had sought admission to the Communist Party above everything else in life. How I had come home pridefully when I achieved this. I thought about going to college and graduating and getting a job that paid money even in the midst of the famine, and how I had kept my family safe, owing, I thought at the time, to my intelligence and hard work, even though so many others had starved to death. I thought about all the conversations I had had with my parents in those years after I came back from the military and how everything they had shared with me had fallen on deaf ears. I thought about how I had forgotten God and failed to rely on Him. I thought about how I had relied only on my own brilliance. As I came to look back on it all, I also remembered the Sundays at my grandfather's house and the question and answer sessions in the shadow of the pine trees along the beach and Hanani. We end there for this time and hope that you will join us again next week, next Sunday, when we deal with the book These Are the Generations by Pastor Eric Foley. Psalm 78:12 is where we began today. Marvelous things God did in the sight of their fathers.